outside the patient millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding axes.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tom Edsel, who's a professor of journalism at Columbia University, who writes a weekly column for The New York Times. He covered American politics at The Washington Post from 1981 to 2006, and before that at The Baltimore Sun and The Providence Journal. His books include Building Red America, Chain Reaction, The Impact of Race, Rights, and Taxes on American Politics, Power and Money, Writing About Politics, The New Politics of Inequality, and most recently, The Age of Austerity. His latest article at The New York Times is How Did Conservatives Get This Radical? Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Edsel.
Good to be with you.
And can you answer your question? I know you've written about it, but this is radio. So how did they get to be so radical?
Well, what I'm suggesting in the article is that the conservatives in the Tea Party and in the House of Representatives, who were farthest on the right, represent kind of a subset of conservatives, that both liberals and conservatives have different character traits, and some of them are beneficial. Conservatives can be loyal, they can be consistent, reliable in certain circumstances, and they actually tend to be cleaner and neater than liberals. At the same time, there are some conservative traits that, when they overwhelm the others, can produce destructive behaviors, which is what I think we're seeing now in Congress. This can be a much more demand for principled opposition and a refusal to compromise, a tendency to see adversaries as enemy outgroups, a inclination to protect the established order, which can be one of inequality and basically what many would consider a growing degree of inequality. To this can be seen as something that needs to be protected as opposed to something that should be challenged. And I think that these characteristics are stronger and have overwhelmed some of the beneficial characteristics of conservatism in the Tea Party and in the hard right of the Republicans in Congress.
So, Thomas Edsel, if the Tea Party conservatives and the Ted Cruzes of this world are protecting the privileges of the ultra-wealthy, who, after all, in many ways, in many cases, are their backers, like the Koch brothers and the Club for Growth, which is funded by wealthy plutocrats. They started out, of course, as a spontaneous right-wing populist revolt against the TARP bailout on Wall Street and have somehow morphed into fealty for billionaires. So what explains their passion? Are they driven by the real ideology? Can one have an ideology of total and absolute dedication to the Koch brothers? Or would that explain why they're so irrational, that it doesn't make sense, that at the end of the day, they're not really helping the people, they're helping the billionaires? I'm trying to figure out where the passion comes from. Is it out of insecurity or out of conviction?
Well, some studies that insecurity is a big factor, that the fear of disruption and the fear of change are major factors in this kind of conservative thinking. But there's also a fundamental difference on the left and the right on the views of the poor. People on the right, they distinguish between what they see as the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. The undeserving poor tend to be those who have caused their own problems by having babies, by quitting high school, by committing crimes, by failing to learn good work habits. The deserving poor are people who are disabled or have been struck by tragedy. The deserving poor should get some government support. The undeserving, in this view, should not. This has translated into much more acceptance on their side of the kind of Koch ideology that government is taking away through taxes for the benefit of the non-deserving poor. This actually has been an ongoing issue since the Civil Rights Revolution and the growing perception then that welfare and other programs like food stamps were basically helping undeserving minorities, particularly black Americans.
So Thomas Edsel, again, professor of journalism at Columbia University, who writes a weekly column for the New York Times, and his latest book is The Age of Austerity, and his latest article at the New York Times is How Did Conservatives Get This Radical? So that may explain, of course, what you've just told us, the jihad against food stamps in the Republican House. But on the other hand, one of the Republican congressmen who's leading the fight to put, I think, 20 million more Americans, basically, no, 20 million more children are going to go hungry and 40 million more Americans are going to lose food stamps. This fellow in Tennessee is the biggest recipient of farm subsidies for his farm, which is a form of right-wing welfare. So how do you explain, I guess I'm asking for some intellectual consistency here, but how do you explain, on the one hand, that there are people that have turned the government into their own piggy banks, and at the same time, they want to punish the undeserving poor? How can this person consider themselves that deserving, where they get millions in subsidies and are quibbling over 20 extra cents for a carton of milk?
I mean, I think, in fact, the Tennessee guy that you referred to has received something like $3.5 million in subsidies, probably a lot to not farm. But people in the farming business view federal programs as a kind of insurance, so that in the case of a drought or some other negative event, bad storms, hurricanes, tornadoes, that they are protected, and that gives them the incentive then to gamble on farming. I'm not justifying it. Frankly, I think that the two are both, that the farm subsidies are as, in the main, as undeserved as anything that conservatives would cite as going to the undeserving poor. There is no consistency, and it is the capacity of people to fail to see their own hypocrisy is another whole terrain.
Well, one of the things that I find about the current political environment, which was very manifest during the so-called faux filibuster of Ted Cruz's, is the extent to which these Tea Party-type politicians and Cruz's, in fact, in many ways, led the revolt both in the Senate and the House. It was so obvious that he was using the Senate chamber as a publicity platform, a fundraising platform for himself, to both demonstrate his fealty to the Koch brothers and those who fund him, at the same time placate his more radical Tea Party base at home in Texas, and with an eye to getting a lot of publicity because he apparently plans to run for the presidency in 2016. He's been getting all the publicity. You have to admit that even if the Republicans go down in flames in the next few days or weeks, and then they'll come back in the middle of this next month with threatening to shut down the full faith and credit of the United States, they're certainly getting a lot of publicity. So is that a fault of our press? Because, you know, the press is going to do their he said, she said routine over this shutdown. It's not going to be entirely clear to the average American that this is happening because of a bunch of Republican extremists. Do you think that message is going to get across?
Well, I've noticed actually lately that there's been more and more pressure in the press to stop the equivocation kind of reporting of he said, she said, and without any analytical part of it evaluating what's really going on. And then it tends to be somewhat in sort of the liberal, somewhat elite press, but it is beginning to become more and more of an issue. And the current budget crisis and what may become a debt crisis later this month really point to this problem of reporting where you give each side a balance in the notion that that's fair, when in fact you're being unfair to the reader. It's been an ongoing problem, and that's another whole debate, and it goes back really to 1980 when Republicans won the presidency, the Senate, and really had a conservative majority in the House. And the liberal press was very stunned by this and never really recovered.
So on the other point, Thomas Edsel, about Ted Cruz grandstanding and getting a lot of press as a result, is that just a case of the squeaky wheel getting the oil?
Well, in part, there's a few things. One is that, though, the press also loves conflict, and Ted Cruz's conflict, not just with Democrats, but within the Republican Party. He has a lot of enemies now in the Republican Party, and the press delights in reporting these internal Republican disputes. So it's not all, in a sense, just giving him a bigger platform. But it certainly is benefiting him. And what it's a reflection of is that Ted Cruz's constituency is really the Republican primary electorate. That's what he needs in order to win his seat in the Senate, and it's what he would be going after were he to run for president. And that primary constituency is much more conservative than Republicans as a whole and way more conservative than voters as a whole. So he, by staking out these positions, he benefits himself extensively by drawing this kind of attention and winning this kind of publicity. It's a dilemma. You can't, as a reporter, not cover Ted Cruz, but it's a tough issue, and I don't think there's an easy answer to it.
So let's get into trying to understand, you know, without venturing into cheap psychiatry, but just to understand the kind of resurgence of tribalism and xenophobia in the Republican Party that's largely being captured by Southern white evangelical conservatives. Is it simply that their fear of the demographic change? And it's, of course, having an African-American for president, I suppose, is somewhat in your face if you're concerned about that. What is behind it? Because a lot of people have pointed to the incipient racism in some of their phobia and irrational hatred of Obama. And Obama's even addressed it himself, you know, just saying, you know, if you want to hate me, that's one thing, but don't deny health care to the millions of Americans because of it, you know.
I think that the overall fact that the country is becoming, the white majority is soon to become a minority, is a big concern to conservatives. Secondly, conservatives dominated politics from 1968, really through the election of George W. Bush. And even under Clinton, the Republicans took control of both branches of Congress. That centrality and power is threatened by the demographic changes in this country, and especially the rise of Hispanics and Asian American voters. And I think that does cause a lot of anxiety in the Republican Party, which is overwhelmingly a white party. So that's a big contributing factor. Secondly, I think that the Democrats have put together the Obama coalition includes a much stronger base of voters who seek a more activist government. They are minorities, and they are much more in favor of the government intervening in behalf of the poor and those in the bottom half of the income distribution. All of these developments are very disconcerting to those on the right. And they do legitimately see a real challenge to what had been their over three-decade-long kind of political hegemony in the United States. They see that disappearing along with the longer-term disappearance of the white majority, and that does represent a big threat to the right.
But it seems to be, though, going back to the congressman who gets over $3 million subsidy for his farm not to grow crops, and he's the one that's leading the charge against poor people needing food stamps. And if you add up ag subsidies, the military-industrial complex, the terrorist-industrial complex, the enormous oil and gas subsidies, it's, if you really look at the at who gets the benefits of our tax money and who gets the tax breaks, it's pretty hard to make the case as Romney did in that tape that haunted him and may have cost him the election, that where he talked about the 47%, basically, you know, they'll vote for Democrats because they're all freeloaders, that in fact, you know, this is kind of a bribe that the Democrats just pay these people, throw them a bone to get their votes, and that they're basically, they don't contribute. They're the takers and we are the makers. But my sense is that the makers that Romney's talking about, they're the ones with their snouts in the government trough more than anybody. I mean, has anybody done a breakdown of corporate and right-wing subsidy versus left-wing subsidy?
That's a good question, and it would be it would depend on what you call subsidy, of course. Is our food stamps a subsidy? Or conversely, it depends on whether you're on the receiving end or the paying end. And farmers do not consider themselves getting subsidies, whereas many others would consider them. But you make a good point, and I don't know of a study like that. There probably has been, but I am not aware of it offhand.
So what do you think then explains this kind of, you know, what some have called cruelty? Obama recently mentioned that the Koch brothers are now funding this effort to encourage college kids not to get health care. And basically, they've been sending me their stuff, so I've been reading their propaganda, which talks about this Ponzi scheme, and, you know, you're just going to get taken in, so don't sign up. And Obama made the case, or made a quip, saying, well, you know, if you get sick, if you're a college kid, I don't expect the Koch brothers to pay your medical bills. So there's this strange kind of callousness that's coming out now. And is that sort of a part of that appeal that to the endangered white man, that screw these other guys because they're all screw these minorities because they're all freeloaders, and this is the, if the government is doing that to you, then they're evil? Are they creating a kind of scenario here of demonizing this government that, if anything, is ineffective as opposed to unfair?
Well, I would argue that what the Koch brothers in this case are trying to do is to undermine the Obamacare as much as possible. In order to work Obamacare, you have to get the healthy to sign up, especially the young healthy, so that they're not freeloaders. If they don't sign up, then the cost of insurance to those who do get coverage goes up because the healthy ones are taken out of the pool, therefore the average cost goes up. They want to undermine that and make Obamacare not work. They see Obamacare as another step to strengthening the relationship between government and the citizens of the country. Just as Social Security and Medicare are sort of crucial lifelines for the elderly, Obamacare they see as a threat in the sense that they see taxpayer-financed government programs as a threat to the free enterprise system, that the government will just be taking more away in order to finance subsidies to the poor instead of allowing corporate America to have a free hand to exercise its will. So I'm not sure it's just a matter of cruelty. It's a strategic stance designed to protect their economic interests.
But how is it working? I mean, surely the average Americans had some interaction with insurance companies. The idea...
Now, they're talking now to the group that does not get insurance
Right. But in general, I get that. But in general, the argument is, and this, I guess this is a libertarian argument, is that, you know, government's bad and free enterprise and corporate America is good. So where's the evidence of any kind of altruism on the part of corporate America? I mean, has anybody tested that theory that if you get rid of government, suddenly corporate America is going to lavish you with opportunities and largesse?
They would argue that the private sector is the fundamental source of employment in America, and taking money away from the private sector through tax collections to provide benefits to generally poor people undermines the ability of the private sector to provide jobs that those poor people could get, in theory, and then get corporate paid-for health plans, in some cases at least.
Well, I guess just in closing, there's not a lot of stuff that we get for our tax dollars from the government. But the two things we get is for elderly people in Medicare and Social Security, and they've both been under assault. And had Social Security been privatized when George W. Bush made an effort to do so, what would have happened to it after the 2008 crash? It's just the empirical evidence seems to be so great that we actually need better government, not more government or less government, but just better government. And the alternative seems to be a myth that somehow the free market is going to take care of you. I don't get it.
Well, I think that you're trying to make a rational argument when this is not a rational debate. And this is a ideological debate.
Mm-hmm.
And people have ideologically based commitments that preclude some considerations that come up when, as you point out, certain rational factors that people engaged in bitter ideological disputes tend to rule out information contrary to their point of view. This is true in climate science. It's true in evolutionary teaching, for example. You're applying rationality to an irrational system.
Well, that's a good note to close on, since we're witnessing today irrationality run amok. So I thank you for joining us, Tom Edsall.
Thank you. Sure.
Again, I've been speaking with Tom Edsall. He's a professor of journalism at Columbia University. He writes a weekly column for The New York Times. He covered American politics at The Washington Post from 1981 to 2006, and before that at The Baltimore Sun and The Providence Journal. His books include Building Red America, Chain Reaction, The Impact of Race, Rights, and Taxes on American Politics, Power and Money, Writing About Politics, The New Politics of Inequality, and most recently, The Age of Austerity. His latest article at The New York Times is How Did Conservatives Get This Radical? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.